Hey, far out, man. Welcome to this podcast from Third Flatiron Publishing in Boulder, Colorado, and Ayr, Scotland. We're grooving on this tale by Sharon Diane King called A Touch of the Grape. A woman who has come to dispose of her deceased aunt's possessions unwittingly finds the key to happiness within her aunt's mobile home community. For some readers, it will be a trip down memory lane, if, that is, the lane is San Francisco's Lombard Street. Sharon grew up in California's San Joaquin Valley and has an advanced degree in comparative literature. She runs a medieval theatrical group. She and her husband have written and produced several short films, one of which, Plant Life, won an award for Best Mockumentary. See the author interview accompanying this podcast. This story first appeared in the Third Flatiron anthology, Rhapsody of the Spheres. For more from Third Flatiron, check out our website at thirdflatiron.com and subscribe to our podcasts. You can support our podcasts at patreon.com/thirdflatiron. And now, let's hear A Touch of the Grape, read by Christine Guzzi.
A Touch of the Grape by Sharon Diane King. Norma Lamoureux straightened up from the banker's box, wincing at the pain in her lower back. She pushed back a lock of graying hair, sneezed, sighed deeply, sneezed again. Even before her Aunt Louise had left her double-wide for hospice care, her house had been mired in the dust of decades. Even a sturdy K95 mask, worn religiously, did not go far. But the friends and neighbors' grab bag, Norma's invitation for coffee and cookies, and the chance to leave with sundry mementos from her aunt's house, had been an undeniable success. To wit, Norma no longer had to find a home for her aunt's zebra collection, once occupying nearly all of the spare room. The widower down the block had secured the tinkly goat bell on its embroidered ribbon destined for his truck. Isabel, a tiny woman with twinkling hazel eyes and thick white hair, had nabbed half a dozen framed prints of mountain climbs, the Alps, the Himalayas, Mount Fuji. Louise's perennially becurled next-door neighbor would now cherish her friend's memory via a pearly porcelain egg bearing the dewy-eyed face of Jesus set on a gilt stand. Her aunt's antique brass candle snuffer? Out the door. Her assortment of amulets and talismans? Disappeared. One by one, friends had walked off with treasures, appliances, tools, linens. A book they might never finish, a record they would never play. A few had even carried away an album or two of Louise's exploits to Guam, Lapland, Sri Lanka, Ghana, Bali. Though Norma had selfishly squirreled away for herself the notebook of her aunt's trip to the Galapagos. There, in snapshot after fading snapshot, was her auntie in a gray swimsuit with bold red flowers, flattened on the rocks amidst a colony of salt-brayed marine iguanas. All were basking in the cloud-minded sun, sharing the same Mona Lisa smile. One item that had not, alas, departed the premises, the still dusty in places cluster of large acrylic grapes set among pale green plastic leaves on a thick stem of twisted driftwood. Most of the lucite globes were of a clear amber color, heaven knows why, but a few, heightening the surreal abnormality of the piece, were shot through with white, giving them a milky tinge. Norma struggled to recall where she might have seen the knick-knack in its heyday, during one of her visits to her aunt at her old home. Atop the china cabinet, perhaps? Or on the hi-fi next to the silver coffee service that had always needed polishing and never got it? No matter. Once its era had passed, the cluster had been shunted into a box, tucked away in a closet, and forgotten. Until Norma rediscovered it, dusted it off with a rag, and set it prominently on a small inlaid wood table that had belonged to Louise's mother. "Look at this," Norma had said, smiling, as trinket-laid guests headed for the door. "A 70s classic. Now it's retro. We've lived that long." Some of her visitors had nodded, passing a finger gently over the smooth spears, chuckling at the thought of how bizarrely ubiquitous they had been decades ago. Others had picked up the cluster, marveling at the heft, the unabashed artifice of the object. but nobody took it with them. Ah, well, Norma shrugged as she locked up after the last neighbor, clutching an opaque Tupperware full of oatmeal crispies, had left. To the Goodwill tomorrow, and she fell into bed. The blaring of car horns, trailing back half a mile, had reached an outraged crescendo when the uniformed man strode up to the battered pickup. "Sir, is there a problem?" The wizened, balding man, with 2 days' growth of stubble, shook his head, his face fixed on the road ahead of him. "Sir, I'm afraid you can't stop your car here." The man nodded, his eyes still focused straight ahead. He smiled. The car did not budge. The officer took a breath. "Sir, just start your truck and move on. I won't sight." "Woo-hoo! Take a look at that one," the man interrupted, bouncing on the padded seat, making the goat bell hanging from the rearview mirror give a merry tinkle. He turned, grinning, to the policeman. "Can't move till they've all gone past, can I?" The officer stared. "They? The parade. Never seen anything like it, man." The grizzled man let out a whoop. "That float with the troll dolls shooting out of the giant Jiffy Pop pan? Far out." He tossed his head as if shaking back long lost locks. "But who know cowbells could ride polka dot steers and do macrame? And that buck naked band that just passed playing the streaker?" He pounded on the steering wheel. "Don't look, Ethel." The policeman gazed at the man's euphoric grin, his blown out pupils, then at the utterly unremarkable intersection in front of them. He took a step towards the pickup's open window, sniffed deeply, pondered for a moment. He shrugged. "Sir, could I ask you to please step out of the cab?" The man gazed over the man's shoulder, pursed his lips. "No problemo, officer. But could you tell that big old honeybee buzzing around you to fly off first? I'm really allergic." The policeman passed his hand over his eyes, sighed, and called for backup. "I'm sorry, young man," a voice quavered softly. The freckled-faced bank teller looked up from his till and met two wine-dark eyes becalmed in a sea of wrinkles. He nodded, trying to hide his confusion. "I don't want you to be afraid or upset," the tiny woman with thick white hair went on, glancing down at her handbag, a capacious brown number in peeling faux leather. Her mouth curved upward, showing small but powerful teeth. "But I have something in here for you you won't like, and I will use it if you don't give me $1,400 cash." The teller's face paled, even to the freckles. "Larger bills, please. Time's of the essence. It's for Godzilla." Her hazel eyes peered past the teller as if seeing far into the distance. She waved, smiling toothily once more. The teller glanced over his shoulder at the blank wall. He gulped. The woman shifted from one foot to the other as the teller counted frantically. She hummed to herself, giving occasional giggles interspersed with gasps, as if all of her dreams were coming true. The wide-eyed youth, trembling, waited until the frail hands with their prominent veins had grasped the money before he pressed the panic button, which of course was out of order again. The woman smiled once more as she snapped closed the hasp of her purse. "Poor Godzilla. Can't fight that nasty smog monster without our help. Thank you, young man." "Hey, Mom," Colleen Chepstow's voice rang out from the den. "Come see what I just whipped up for Dad's birthday." Her mother rounded the corner from her home office, stopped short in the doorway. "I found this old sewing machine at your friend Louise's estate sale," Colleen said, her long silky hair tumbling around her shoulders. "Giveaway, I mean. So much free stuff. There was this old bunch of grapes. It was so cool. But the machine I knew I could use right away. And I did, see?" She held up the outfit with a flourish. "It's a leisure suit," she said, oblivious to her mother's open-mouthed stare. "Just his size. Material's just too groovy, right?" "Your father will be overcome. That much is true," Mrs. Chepsaw thought frantically. The suit's fabric, evidently once a bedspread, was of a paisley chintz, in which placid greens and browns alternated with petulant crimsons and irate ochres. Her daughter had paired it with a rainbow peace sign print shirt she had dug out of the far reaches of her father's closet. The ensemble's eye-watering smell gave assurance that no moth larvae would come near her parent for many generations, if ever. Mrs. Chepstow gazed at the cacophony on a hanger dangling in wait for her unsuspecting mate, then at her daughter's starry eyes, her smile of joyous pride, she swallowed, "It's lovely, sweetheart, lovely." Norma awoke to the buzzing of her cell. She blinked, wincing. The sun was streaming in the bedroom window, much too energetically. She groped for her phone. "Hello? Norma, this is Don Raymond. Ellen won't be able to pick up that clay pot of Louise's she wanted today," the elderly voice rasped. "Can she come by, maybe tomorrow?" "Sure, Don," Norma said, gazing around her in confusion. The room seemed to grow and shrink every time she turned her head, like a sped-up version of Alice through the looking glass. "Is she ill?" "Nope, in jail. Have to go bail her out," the soft voice said matter-of-factly. "Gotta get the funds together. Don't know how long it'll take." "In jail?" Norma sat up immediately. Wish she hadn't. She clutched her forehead. Were things with wings lurking in the corners of the ceiling? What happened? "Don't know what got into her, but this morning she got up onto the roof at City Hall and belted out a rendition of I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing," he let out with a sigh. "That might not have landed her in jail, but the bra-burning part did," he chuckled. "She did look good up there, have to say." "Okay, well," Norma took a swallow from the water bottle on the nightstand and swatted at the fairies in iridescent tutus that had descended and were now circling above her. "Phew. What was that, Norma?" "Nothing, Don. You take care of Ellen. The pottery will keep." "Thanks." She fell open-eyed back onto her pillows. The fairies circling her head linked arms and began a rhapsodic chorus of Three Dog Night's Joy to the World. Norma's taut face rearranged itself into a smile. Norma's head was spinning, not merely because she had been seeing horse racing candy bars, singing wiener wagons, and tangoing cats every time she opened her eyes for 3 days straight, not because she saw them even when she didn't open her eyes. No, it was the non-stop contacts from her Aunt Louise's friends and neighbors that had been upending Norma's world. "We just loved Louise, and you look so much like her," Dolores Chepstow murmured as she stepped into the living room. "Here's a coffee cake I just baked. You know, I could put on a pot of Uban, and we could visit if you have the time. Before I forget, my daughter Colleen knitted this pair of potholders for you. Oh, and she mentioned a funky bunch of grapes you had put out somewhere, and I just had to see." Norma, now counting half a dozen crocheted afghans, draped over her aunt's love seat. A plethora of copies of Jonathan Livingston Seagull and I'm Okay, You're Okay cluttered the coffee table. Around the room, there was an explosion of Avon collectibles, sand candles, down to the dregs bottles of Anjali and Love's Lemon Fresh Perfume. Mood rings, pet rocks, ornamental gewgaws displaying love. But Norma's visitors came to her bearing other gifts, their stories, most of which were, truth to be told, implausible in the extreme. The becurled neighbor swore a phalanx of scrubbing bubbles had been duking it out with Mr. Clean in the cleaning supplies aisle in the supermarket. The widower claimed to have seen a giant Alka-Seltzer tablet plopping into the municipal pool, causing it to fizz up all over the swimmers and prompting a near riot. Who would challenge them? Norma herself had witnessed the Fruit of the Loom underwear guys crooning Rocky Mountain High to her in the kitchen that very morning, and the neighbors' follow-up tales of traffic citations and lockup details seemed to bear out their accounts. But the constant interruptions, the cornucopia of curios, did not bother Norma. Quite the opposite. She was filled to bursting with joy at the bounty of visits, the unending stream of new friends that had emerged, unbidden, from the chore of dealing with her aunt's estate. She had never before had neighbors drop by and stay chatting for hours in all her solitary, quiet, workaday world. Moreover, the universe her new companions brought with them was infinitely comforting, a kind of déjà vu on steroids. Norma's nostrils were filled with the scents of patchouli and sandalwood from reanimated potpourris brought over in ornamental jars. On her aunt's improbably still functioning hi-fi, "I Can See Clearly Now" vied with black and white for prominence and guests danced rhapsodically, albeit equally spasmodically, around the living room, was de rigueur. Norma's refrigerator freezer now teemed with retro familiar foods. Meatless tamale pie, tuna casserole, jello molds of both sweet and savory persuasions, Watergate cake, endless variations on seven-layer dip. The mini pizzas that had once been all the rage were flawlessly recreated one evening by Louise's friend Ellen, once she was sprung from jail, split toasted English muffins covered with tinned marinara and shredded mozzarella and set under the broiler. After far too many of these, accompanied by Don's endless pours from a gallon bottle of Matus, Norma had slumped over the table in a carb overload and slept there all night. She awoke the next morning groggy, but invigorated and with a problem. She didn't want to leave. "I'm sorry," the mobile home's administrator said, tapping his finger on the red-bordered contract on the table. "Ms. Lemereau, your aunt left you her estate, but the mobile home space is a lease. She can't have left that to you. She didn't own it. And we have already leased the space. That home, I'm sorry to say, is going to be demolished at the beginning of next month." Norma gazed at him levelly. "I'm a senior now. I qualify for admission to this park, correct?" "Correct. We can put you on the list. You'd be at the top right now, but you are not entitled to that space. That's already been rented." Norma's face clouded. "By whom?" "I can't tell you that. Just, well, someone else close who wants to turn it into his garden. I mean, their garden. We allow that if they pay the full rental price every month." Norma gazed at the floor, chilled. The one neighbor who had not responded to her invitation, on the other side of her aunt's home, was a man with a withering glare. There was little doubt who her adversary was. "He, I mean they, already paid, you say? But the month isn't over yet." "Well," the administrator's voice trailed off, "sometimes they get a little eager, and we let them have dibs. Long-term tenants, if you know what I mean." Norma stared out the window. All the shared goodwill of the past several days had drained out of her, and she felt hollow. "Thank you for your time, I guess. Put me on your list. I'll drop off the papers tomorrow." Norma sat at the dining room table with her fifth cup of coffee. She was clear-eyed in a way she had not been for days. It didn't feel good. Before her was a note with the numbers of moving vans and storage sheds. She picked up her cell phone, put it down again. Her glance fell on the inlaid table on which sat the cluster of grapes. She gazed at it for a moment, stood and picked up the arrangement, scrutinizing it from all angles. She turned it over, stared at the label on the bottom. Her eyes widened. "Made of pure hallucinite by Psychedelics Anonymous," the twisting, curving font read. "For your hippy-trippy friends. Fun for all aged." Norma sat down and poured herself the rest of the pot. "I'm sorry, but she absolutely insisted," Norma chirped at the sour-faced man standing well back from his screen door. "It was in her will. She gave away things to a lot of different folks, and that one was to go to you." She lowered her voice. "I have to tell you, I think there's something valuable hidden inside. Maybe in the wood stem piece, or in the spheres." She kind of hinted at that. The glaring eyes lit up. The screen door swung open. "I'll take it. Thanks." "Bon voyage, and we'll miss you," read the signs in front of the mobile home. There were clusters of colorful balloons outside, some twisted into the shapes of tortoises and lizards. Inside the house, bedecked with flowers and seashells, Norma presided over great dishes of lobster rice, plantains, and grilled octopus, while Don Raymond kept popping open more than a few bottles of fine vintages for the partygoers. "Well, the place won't be the same without you," his wife said, shaking her head. 3 weeks in the Galapagos." Norma's face lit up. "Can you believe it? Longest trip I've ever taken. Pretty much the only one I've been on in decades," she smiled. "I can't wait to swim with the iguanas." "Just like your aunt," chimed in Isabel, raising her glass. She waxed rhapsodic every time she talked about it. "But the best part will be the homecoming," Colleen Chepstow enthused. "We'll make sure to have this place all cleaned up, ready for your welcome to your new home party." Her mother chuckled, from one rapturous moment to the next. "Have to say, I don't know what got into Garvey Hilds, changing his mind about this space so quick," Don observed in his soft rasp. "He never struck me as very flexible." "Well, he said he's coming to this party," Norma smiled. "I wouldn't trouble him much about it, really. He said he's been having trouble sleeping. Something about demons and hellhounds chasing him all night long. He'll be ready for a nice touch of the grape, don't you think?"
Thanks for listening to this podcast from thirdflatiron.com.